Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Welcome back to the Kennedy Dynasty Podcast. I'm your host, Allison, and today I have everyone's favorite, once again. I don't even know why I intro you anymore. Everyone just knows you're going to be on it, but it is Ryan Pryor.
Everybody's voting for Jack, because he's got what all the rest lack. Jack is on the right track. I was just trying to continue the intro music.
I thought what you were going to do was insert your name into that, and then I was like, let's not do that. But you didn't.
I wasn't. No, I didn't. Why would I do that?
I don't know. I just thought that's where you were.
I want my own song. And I wouldn't have had Frank Sinatra write it. I would have had Dean Martin write it.
Well, he was buddies with Frank Sinatra, so it made sense.
Yeah, well, he should have been buddies with Dean Martin.
Who's to say he wasn't?
That's true.
Dean. Next episode.
I'm a big fan of Dean Martin, as you might be aware.
I know you are. I like Dean Martin, too.
I love Dean.
What's your favorite song? I'll insert a clip.
What's my favorite Dean Martin song, Caroline? My Rifle, My Pony, and Me. It's from Rio Bravo.
Here it is, fam.
Sweetheart, darling.
Sweetheart, darling.
Just my rifle, pony, and me. Just my rifle, my pony, and me.
All right, that was great.
Whippoorwill in the canyon. Anyway.
We already played it. It's good.
That is my favorite Dean Martin song.
So, as everyone knows, too, it's tradition for Ryan and I to have a drink together, and I just had to yell at him. And I'm not the peer pressure, like, you have to drink person, but he was all like, oh, I drank whiskey last night, and I'm not into it. And I was like, it's our tradition. We have to have a drink together. So, what are you drinking, Ryan?
I'm having a cold beer.
Cold beer.
I'm having a cold beer.
What's your brand? Cold.
It's Miller Lite. Miller Lite. Miller Lite. That's generally what I drink.
Girl. But
yeah, I mean, that doesn't surprise me.
What's that supposed to mean? Is there a stigma?
I'm not saying there's a stigma. I'm just saying that there are Bud Light people and there are Miller Light people.
Oh, you think you're cooler than me or higher class?
No, I don't. No, these are both light beers, but just, you know, Bud Light is, you know.
Yeah, keep going. What do you have to say?
It's the equivalent of driving a Toyota Camry, okay?
Oof. No, you know? Apologies to everyone who drives a Toyota Camry. Jeez.
I'm not saying, no, the Camry
Mr.
is the most
pretentious the Camry, over here.
The Camry is the most, has been the most popular sold vehicle for the last 20 years in a row. It's a very popular vehicle for a good reason. It's a good, reliable vehicle. However, it has no flash. It has no flash. I'm not saying Miller Lite has much flash, but it's, you know.
Oh, I just noticed you have one more foot you can put in your mouth if you want to. Put your other foot in your mouth. Yeah.
No, I'm saving that for later.
Well, I am having a very nice, because it just feels like 'tis the season. I don't know why. Like, I felt fancy tonight, even though I'm wearing a Mickey Mouse sweatshirt with snowflakes on it. I'm having an extra dirty martini.
What does extra dirty mean?
It means extra olive juice in it.
Oh, I do love olive juice.
Oh, me too. I could drink it straight out of the olive jar.
Are you an olive person?
I am a major olive person. I always have been since I was a kid. Yeah.
So I love the olive bars at, like, the fancy grocery stores. I love those.
Are you go ahead.
I was going to ask, I think there's an olive conspiracy, like that married couples generally don't, like, share the same olive tendency. So, like, Caroline hates olives.
Does Jeffrey. Hates pickles. I love pickles.
Love pickles.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, yeah, that's true. But which is great because I get all the olives off of all of our, like, Greek food, and I get all the pickles off of anything else, which is fantastic.
That's a win. That's a win-win right there.
I'm good with it. I'm totally good with
it. That's
a
double win.
The best thing is, I don't know if I think this might be a Southern thing, but which you would get, but I don't know if the rest of the audience would. Did you ever have chicken biscuit crackers?
My nanny loved those.
It's a delicacy, literally a hidden delicacy, to take a chicken biscuit cracker and put an olive on it. You will go into sodium overload
No.
and you will swell, but it
Dude,
is so good.
I won't be able to take my wedding ring off.
Literally, you'll swell, but it's the best thing ever. So there's your tip for the day.
I'm not eating it. I mean, I'm going to have to try this out, but I still think it's going to be a lot.
It's a lot. Like
chicken biscuit crackers and olives.
It's so good. I promise. Listen, one more question, then we'll get into it. Are you a vodka martini? Are you a martini person at all, or do you not like them?
I can count on my hands the number of times I've had a martini. Okay. I love James Bond. I'm a dark liquor man. I do like Bloody Marys.
Oh, same. So I'm good. That's another thing, too. If you like olives, pickles, whatever, then you like Bloody Marys. If you don't, then you won't. I think
Bloody Marys are an amazing beverage. And I went through a phase in college where I was drinking Bloody Marys like at night. Like nighttime Bloody Marys.
Yeah, I could do
Marys.
That. Totally.
Nighttime Marys.
Yep, I love it. I was going to ask if you were a vodka martini person or a gin martini person.
I'm anti-gin. I think gin is disgusting.
See, I agree on its own, but in a martini, it makes it better. Like, Beefeater makes a better martini. But I'm a vodka girl.
Gin is bad.
Interesting. Hot take. Okay.
I don't know why we would... Let's just flavor... Grain alcohol
like
with juniper berries. No.
Yeah, I get that. But it does make a good martini.
I know some people who are like, they could chug gin. They just love gin that much.
Jeffrey
does.
He drinks it on the rocks.
It's so, I mean, why would I, it tastes like
yeah, it tastes
herbaceous.
Do you know what it tastes like on its own? It tastes like you, and like I said, I like it sometimes, but it tastes like you took like floral, like perfume, and you mixed it in with something. It's just like a little funky, like not how it's supposed to be.
It's not just a little funky. It's very funky.
Beefeater's good. Anyway, I don't know how we can tie this to our topic today, but...
Well, we can because you know who really likes gin? The English.
Who?
In fact, Beefeater gin is an English gin. And the English were one of the four countries that after the end of the Second World War... had a zone of influence or a sphere of influence in the city of Berlin, which is the focus of today's episode.
Fantastic tie-in.
You're welcome.
Impeccable.
Thank you.
Well, I'm excited to learn because I actually don't know a lot about this topic, so I'm stoked. Teach me the things.
Well, it's not really one of the more, it's not an in-depth, there's a lot of detail that we could go into, but of course, you know, this is not one of the other podcasts where they go into every little detail. This is a podcast where we give history to the people who want to hear the history, but maybe who don't want to spend 1,000 years learning about it. So
sure,
we got to do a little backstory here before we start talking about the Berlin Crisis, which is was probably John F. Kennedy's one of the more major Cold War conflicts that he dealt with during his time in the first year of his presidency. And so before we get into the Berlin Crisis of 1961, we have to have a prelude. Prelude.
You always got to do it.
I got to pause.
You got to do it. You got to have the prelude every time.
And we got to talk about this thing called Potsdam, okay? Now, I didn't curse there. Potsdam.
You've talked about this before, right?
I have a little bit.
Okay, I thought
so. And then there's Potsdam and the Yalta Conference. These two conferences, these really, at the end of the Second World War, between Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, and the soon-to-be-dead Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and then the second one was with Truman. And this is where these Allied leaders got together, and they basically were like, listen, we're going to win the war. Germany will be defeated. Hitler is running scared. How are we going to divide up the post-World War world? Okay? And their basic discussion about this country of Germany was that they would divide the country of Germany in twain. It's a great word, by the way, twain. Mm. And they would also divide Berlin in twain, creating two sides, a communist East and a capitalist West. The East would be controlled by the Soviet bloc, the Soviet Union, and the Warsaw Pact. And the West would be controlled by a triumvirate of allies, the French, the British, and the Americans. And so by 1961, what you have is a situation where Berlin is divided into East and West Berlin, and Germany is divided into. But the thing about it is that Berlin is actually situated some 200 miles inside of Communist East Germany. So it's 200 miles from the border between East Germany and West Germany, but it is divided. And so it means that there is this little Western enclave, this little Allied enclave in Communist Germany. Communist Germany, which is also controlled by the Soviet Union. And also, interestingly enough, the people of West Germany had a much higher standard of living than those in East Germany did as well. And that same economic disparity happens in the city of Berlin. I think I've exclaimed before my not love per se of capitalism, but my appreciation for it. And nowhere in the world at any time was there any greater example of why people did not want to live under communism than when it came to East and West Germany / Berlin. So much
hey,
so that by
the capitalism thing, by the way, that's Ryan's opinion.
That is my opinion. Or wait, I think you're just going to put in the already that you already got a clip.
I will, but I'm going to leave that
because it was
great.
I don't have to sing it.
It's gold every time.
That is my opinion. By 1961, 4 million people have either fled from East Berlin to West Berlin to try to live to get a better life, or fled from East Germany to West Germany, because again, standard of living was much lower in East Germany. And to this day, interestingly enough, if you go to Berlin, I've never been to Berlin or haven't been to Berlin yet, but if you look at architecture and color and lamp posts and lighting systems in East and West Germany, you can still tell the difference when you look at a satellite image, because to this day, the electrical like infrastructure and the like buildings of East Berlin are inferior to those of West Berlin to this
wow.
day. And the color dynamics are totally different.
That's nuts.
It's crazy. And so East Germany was losing workers and economic potential. And so this led to a sort of a building or mounting tension betwixt the West and the East, you see. And the leader of Soviet Russia at the time, Nikita Khrushchev, was particularly worried about this growing imbalance between the two sides of Germany. That is how we find ourselves in June of 1961, when John Kennedy is traveling by plane to Vienna for a summit with the Soviet hierarchy. Now that is where we are. Do you have any questions up to this point?
Me?
Madam. Yeah.
I think I'm good. I'm trucking right along.
You're trucking right along?
Yep.
Trying to make your way?
Making my way. Making my way downtown. Walking fast, faces passing.
I'm homebound. And I need you.
Still a bomb.
This is supposed to be a trust building exercise betwixt the Kremlin and White House. The Kremlin is the building in Moscow that is the sort of the seat of power of Russia. Unfortunately, it did the opposite. Khrushchev was so upset that he threatened to cut off West Berlin from the rest of the world. He basically threatened to say West Berlin is no longer accessible to anyone. It's an island. This had happened kind of as the same way earlier back in the Berlin airlift, you might remember, in the 1940s after the end of World War II. And so on July 25th, Kennedy delivered an address to America about the potential for a need to defend American and allied interests in Germany. And this is that speech that you and I were talking about before the episode began.
Yeah,
so if you want
I'll
to put
insert a clip
you want
right,
to, right here.
7 weeks ago tonight, I return from Europe to report on my meeting with Premier Khrushchev and the others. His grim warnings about the future of the world, his aide memoir on Berlin, the subsequent speeches and threats which he and his agents have launched, and the increase in the Soviet military budget that he has announced, have all prompted a series of decisions by the administration and a series of consultations with the members of the NATO organization. In Berlin, as you recall, he intends to bring to an end, through a stroke of the pen, first, our legal rights to be in West Berlin, and secondly, our ability to make good on our commitments to 2 million people of that city. That we cannot permit. We are clear about what must be done, and we intend to do it. I want to talk frankly with you tonight about the first steps that we shall take. These actions will require sacrifice on the part of many of our citizens. More will be required in the future. They will require from all of us courage and perseverance in the years to come. But if we and our allies act out of strength and unity of purpose, with calm determination and steady nerves, using restraint in our words as well as our weapons, I am hopeful that both peace and freedom will be sustained.
So by August of 1961, again, this is not the first time, right, that you know the United States and has under Kennedy has been engaging in international affairs, right? We've talked about the Bay of Pigs, that it happened just a little while earlier. Basically, tensions continued to, you know, escalate, fearing that it would turn into all-out war, but it didn't, because in August of 1961, one bright, dark German morning, the sound of machinery and the sound of bulldozers and workmen began to fill the air of the streets of Berlin. And what the people of West Germany woke up to was the beginning of what would be known as the Berlin Wall. You all probably know about the Berlin Wall, otherwise sometimes referred to as the Iron Curtain. By the end of that day, a barbed wire fence had been erected separating Allied West Berlin and Communist East Berlin. In fact, as we're talking about, all of this planning had been going on for quite some time. In fact, East German hierarchy of communists were really very... they had been planning for this since even before the Vienna summit, before tensions had escalated. They had been stockpiling raw materials. In fact, it was under the first secretary of the Socialist Unity Party, a guy named Walter Ulbricht. And so they spread out all these purchases of raw material, including, and I thought this was super interesting, they bought enough barbed wire to completely surround the entirety of West Berlin. Do you want to know how many miles of barbed wire they bought? Miles, not feet. 97 miles of barbed wire.
Good gracious.
So they bought 97 miles of barbed wire. One day in August, after a garden party, apparently they had a little garden party and they had tea and whatever, Ulbricht signed the order and began work. And this immediately caused Willy Brandt, who was very famously the mayor of West Berlin for a very long time, to get really upset. And he calls Kennedy and he says, hey, you've got to do something about this. You've got to send troops. You've got to send something. And Kennedy had only been president for 6 months, 7 months. And he was like, no, we're not going to do that. What he did do is he made the right decision, because he called upon his faithful servant, Lyndon Baines Johnson, and another guy by the name of Lucius Clay. And they were sent to Berlin to essentially calm the Berliners, the West Berliners, and say, hey, listen, you know, we're here for you, just not in person. Although they did send 1,500 American soldiers in their place. And also afterwards, Kennedy did mobilize 148,000 National Guardsmen and soldiers as well, and sent over, I think, 250 some odd planes, from what I remember reading, mobilized a particularly large portion of the Air Corps. Over the course of the next couple of months, between August and October, there was some back and forth. There were some incidences where American troops and Soviet tanks were sort of encroaching on the land at the border wall. And again, just to give you guys an understanding of the Berlin Wall, it wasn't a single straight, like just a big brick wall. It was one wall on the west side, one wall on the east side, with a big like 100-yard area of no man's land in the middle, with like searchlights and barbed wire and stuff and landmines. While they were building the wall, and that first day that they were putting up barbed wire, some 260 people died trying to get from the east side to the west side.
That's so terrible.
It is. Well, I mean, people wanted to get out of, you know, not a lot. No, people didn't want to live in East Berlin, you know.
Right.
It was so bad that afterwards, of course, there's stories of them, of people building tunnels underneath it and all sorts of, and so, trying to get over it in hot air balloons and things like that. I mean, there's some fantastic stories about the Berlin Wall. But nothing actually ended up starting a war. They didn't come close. But tensions eventually did de-escalate. Although, interestingly enough, and I found this out, if you want to know how important this area of the world was at the time, the official exchange point between the east and west side, like one of the major checkpoint on the east side and the west side, the guardsmen in the booth, each one had almost a direct line to either the White House or the Kremlin.
Wow.
Which at the time was considerably, of course, you know, they was old school, you know, I mean, they had the phone line. So like each guardsman had the ability to call like the senior commanders of the like armed forces for both countries. And then those would connect directly to the White House.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, that was considered a point of interest for the entirety of the Cold War. Was that particular area, because there was always some concern that there would be military action happen there.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy did say of the wall at the time, "It is not a very nice solution, but it's a hell of a lot better than war. And that seems to be, you know, the sentiment, I think, a lot of people. The Berlin Wall is not a nice solution necessarily, but it's a hell of a lot better than war. Kennedy was approached by Willy Brandt several times to take some kind of action. He was pushed upon by the more war hawky members of Congress and the United States to do something. In fact, there was at one point some idea from military generals in the United States Army that they could just, as the Soviets were building parts of the wall, they could just destroy other parts of it and just cause the Soviets to quit. But Kennedy felt that was probably not the right approach. And again, he feared war. And Nikita Khrushchev was hell-bent on showing strength as the new premier of the Soviet Union. And so the biggest thing that came out of the Berlin crisis was that both countries, the USSR and the Kennedy administration, or the United States, both began to test nuclear weapons again, which there had been a hiatus on that. And after the Berlin crisis, that really reignited some Cold War tensions that had sort of gone dormant in the late 1950s. And that was sort of it. And that's what happened. 2 years later, in 1963, Kennedy would famously return and speak to the people of Berlin. In fact, it was one of the most celebrated, political tours, political journeys, political ventures, probably in American history. And it is where he delivered his very famous line, which I'm sure you will put in right here.
And there are even a few who say that it's true that communism is an evil system, but it permits us to make economic progress. Lass sie nach Berlin in kommen. Let them come to Berlin. All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
That's sort of it. I mean, that's the story as it lasts. There's certainly much more to it, and we could certainly dig into some of the finer points of the Berlin Wall. But this was Kennedy's second big test. It's probably second big test behind after Bay of Pigs as a negotiator. And it depends. Perception wise, like historically speaking, the Berlin Wall is probably one of the most fascinating things. I think people really tend to focus on it because it was such a physical symbol of the difference between communism and capitalism. The West and the East. But at the end of the day, I think I like to defer to Kennedy's quote about it. It was not a very nice solution, but it was necessary for East Germany. East Germany and the Soviets very much felt it was necessary because they were losing, millions of citizens crossing the border. And they didn't want that to happen anymore. They built a wall. And it was a hell of a lot better than war, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. And thank you so much for bringing that today. I just learned so much about that. I always knew about this. Of course, I've studied basically every facet of Kennedy possible, but in increments, and I feel like I learned a lot about the buildup of that famous speech. So thank you so much for that.
I think there's definitely more to be discussed here.
Sure.
I think
I would love to even go farther into when it was torn down during Reagan's administration, things like that. So
I think there's a lot more. There's a lot more in the day to day. I'm sure that there are some incredible stories from what was going on inside the White House between August and October. But I felt that it was a good idea to just go over the main points of the crisis. And maybe we can, I think with a lot of our episodes, there's a lot of potential to go back and look at more in depth.
Sure. I don't plan on stopping anytime soon. So we got plenty of time. And now I've got some questions for you.
You got some questions for me. Hit me with them.
Yes. I put out a Q&A box and got some responses.
Therefore, in answer to your question,
a couple of them were from your wife. She asked, did you remember to get onions and heavy cream? This was yesterday.
I did. I made lasagna soup for dinner last night, and so I had to get onions and heavy cream.
I'm going to be honest. That sounds nasty.
Why? Do you like lasagna
soup?
Do you like lasagna?
Yeah, in like true form.
Okay. Do you like soup?
Yeah, in true form.
Okay. Essentially, will you just make a loose tomato sauce with like some kind of protein, and then you put your choice of noodle in it, and then you finish it with ricotta cheese. You don't put the ricotta cheese in until the very, like when you put it in the bowl. It's very good.
You're gonna have to make it for me because I don't know how I feel about that. But
okay.
I'm open to it. We'll try it. She also asks when you guys are gonna put up the outside Christmas lights. It is time prior.
The outside Christmas lights.
Are they not happening this year?
We can. She's just going to have to take the initiative.
She's going to have to take the initiative? Get your ass out there on a ladder.
No. Yay. We'll do it on Sunday. I'm hereby
yes,
promising
you will.
That we'll do it
on
Sunday.
And I expect photographic proof to post on my feed so people know your lights are done. Good Lord. All right, back to the questions. This is an interesting one, and you can't state your very obvious answer, okay?
Okay.
We know his favorite president, but who's his least favorite president?
There's so many bad ones. I think that John Quincy Adams was pretty friggin' useless.
Okay,
I mean,
what's your reasoning for that?
I don't know, he had no backbone. Right? He couldn't effectively lead the nation, right? And to be fair, any president that was going to follow Washington was going to have a difficulty. Mm-hmm. And you could see this, of course, in the epic Disney musical,
insert clip, John Adams.
John Adams.
I knew him.
John Adams. I know him. That can't be. That's that little guy who spoke to me all those years ago. What was it, 85? That poor man, they're going to eat him alive.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, Walter. Sorry, not John. No. I didn't mean to say. It's John Adams, not John
Quincy. Yeah, not
Quincy.
Adams. It's a different
not Quincy.
One. I got what you meant.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, two different.
Oh,
we get it.
Okay, well, actually, both the Adams. Honestly, screw him and screw his dad. Here's why. John Adams was a useless president, although, again, you know, good for him for following Washington.
That's the Hamilton
John
reference.
Adams.
Yeah. So good.
I love, who's the guy who plays him?
Jonathan Groff.
His whole thing in the Hamilton is my favorite part. And John Quincy Adams, interestingly enough, is the only president to not be elected by popular vote of the Electoral College. There was an electoral vote tie in the election of 1824. And do you know what happens whenever there's an electoral vote tie? The House of Representatives basically like votes on who becomes the president, and they voted for him. And so, honestly, what a knob. But yeah, John Quincy Adams and his dad, screw both of them.
Wow.
I'm not a super fan. The obvious answers are the ones like who were useless. Like James Buchanan could have done more to prevent the Civil War, but he didn't. He basically like sat there for a year, which is like, I can't wait till the next guy comes in here so I don't have to deal with this.
Yeah.
That is useless. Herbert Hoover. Hoover's whole laissez-faire approach to the Great Depression kind of sucks. I don't like that. I didn't like that. I think he goes down in history as being one of the worst presidents.
I think everyone would agree with that.
I would agree. I would hope they would.
But what's your what's your number one? You got to give me one. Like, what is your least favorite? That was a question.
Was
it John Adams?
No.
Can you stick to that?
No. I'm gonna say. I'm gonna say Woodrow Wilson. And the reason I'm gonna say Woodrow Wilson was because he was just such a virulent racist. Mm-hmm. You know, like the fact is the matter because of Woodrow Wilson and his racism, the first movie ever shown in the White House was The Birth of a Nation. Now that's, I don't like him a lot. It depends on the perception. Like as a human being, Woodrow Wilson sucked. As a president, he was fine. He was fine president. He established the Federal Reserve, for God's sake. I mean, as far as like the individual, Woodrow Wilson, because he was who he was. I'm going to say as far as individual, Woodrow Wilson, and as far as policies, I'm going to say, as far as policies are concerned, it's a hard question.
This is a real challenge for you. I love this question.
Why is this hard for me? If we're looking at hindsight, historical hindsight, yeah, it's going to have to be Woodrow Wilson as an individual for being an absolute POS, and then, yeah, Herbert Hoover for dealing with the Great Depression the way that he did.
There it is. Okay, next question. If you could meet one Kennedy, living or dead, who would it be?
Ooh, I would want to meet, I'm going to say this. This is going to be an interesting statement. I would want to meet probably Jackie.
Really? I thought you said Bobby.
No, I think Jackie was pretty cool. Yeah.
Well, I think that's all I've got. All right, Ryan. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. Once again, I'm sure you'll be back next month or the next or whenever, if you will do it. That would be amazing.
Yeah, I have one that I want to do, and I want to do it on the history of Wayfarer sunglasses or like Wayfarers. I don't know why. you know, the sunglasses, the very popular Ray-Ban sunglasses. And you wanted to
dive into that history?
I don't know why. I love sunglasses. I'm a big sunglasses fan. I thought it might be a nice, fun one. We normally do pretty academic stuff, but like, you know, doing something about sunglasses, you know?
Hell yeah. January, here it comes. Well, follow me on Instagram at Kennedy Dynasty. Check out the link in the description of this episode for my merch shop. Last minute Christmas shopping. Get it done for you because you deserve it, or for any Kennedy fans in your life. And if you like the episode and you like the podcast, please rate it 5 stars and write a positive written review. And please make sure that you are subscribed. That's all I got. And I'll talk to you guys next week.
Come on and vote for Kennedy. Vote for Kennedy. Keep America strong.
Hello everyone, my name is Tom Kearns and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.